Good morning, everyone. I'd like to informally call us this meeting, the Labor and Consumer Protection Division, to order. We are one short of quorum. Ah, we have a quorum. Thank you to whoever just walked in the room. But I do want us to get going. We have a number of bills on the agenda today. The first one is House File 2599. Am I correct about that? Yes. Representative Falk, good morning and welcome to the committee, sir. The chair will move that House File 2599 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. I understand there's an amendment in members' packets. It should be the 2599A1 amendment. Mm-hmm. Representative Falk, is this your amendment, sir?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I do not believe this is our amendment. So
you do or do not?
Do not believe it is our amendment.
Oh, isn't that interesting, then? All right.
Well, okay. It's always nice to have some.
All right. Well, we'll hold off on the amendment then. I apologize. Representative Falk, if you wish to make some opening statements to your bill, I see the Attorney General's office is here. Good morning, Mr. Fichte. And why don't you proceed on your bill, Representative Falk?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill prohibits the usage of live checks primarily by third parties. Sometimes when you engage in a transaction with a retailer, you are providing payment for some form of good or service. However, if that party in which you perform the transaction sells your information to a third party, that third party may in fact solicit business through you through, I would deem to be, unscrupulous manners, oftentimes offering rebate checks that look like they're coming from the manufacturer, the company that provided the service, but when in fact they're not. And so by cashing that check, typically it's in a small denomination, less than $10, you may in fact be signing up for an ongoing or recurring service that bills your account monthly or annually at some exorbitant rate. And so this bill aims to curb that practice. Mr. Fritke here has done a phenomenal job of helping me to understand the issue, and I would like to allow him the opportunity to offer his comments as well.
Thank you. Mr. Fichte, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kermit Fichte. I'm an assistant attorney general in the Attorney General's office. I'm here to testify briefly in support of Representative Falk's bill and answer any questions that the committee may have. The bill would prohibit the use of so-called live checks as a means to obligate consumers to sign up and pay for goods and services. I want to start out by saying that the bill does not make any changes to the laws governing loan solicitations by banks or other lenders that are regulated by Section 47.06. As Representative Falk said, these checks are typically in small amounts, $10 or less, and cashing the check obligates a consumer to pay for a good or service, usually a service, on their credit card through the use of a recurring charge. These charges are typically in the range of $100 to $150. Now, you members in your packet, you should have an example of a live check. It looks something like this. And the watermark has been darkened so you can read the disclosure language, maybe read the disclosure language that's in there, but it is much lighter on the actual check. This is particularly a problem because most of the victims that our office sees are elderly and can't read what we would view as an inadequate disclosure. Now, signing a live check, you may wonder how charges get put on a person's credit card. Well, what has happened is through pre-acquired account marketing, a company that the consumer has a business relationship with, and there's companies that come to mind are Petty Paws, pet things, and you've seen these Snuggies on TV. You buy one of those with your credit card. They have sold information to these third-party marketers that include your credit card information. So by simply signing this check, a consumer signs this check, it gets returned to this third-party marketer. They've got the consumer's credit card information, and they start putting charges on there. And consumers don't have any knowledge, don't have any consent, and these aren't, as I said earlier, the live checks, the financial arrangements that banks and other lenders use. what's purchased by these live checks, mostly they're things like buying clubs, or one of them is actually something called ID theft protection. Our office received a complaint saying, I got this charge on my credit card. I think someone stole my ID, and we had to explain, no, actually, you purchased ID theft protection. You just didn't know it. Three other states, Nebraska, Utah, and Alaska, have adopted similar legislation. And this is a growing problem. Our office has seen over 100 complaints in the last several years, and that number is continuing to grow. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Any questions for the testifiers or the author of the bill? Does anybody want to claim ownership over the A1 amendment? All right. Representative Falk, any closing comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, I thank you for your time, and I would ask for your support on this measure. It should be a fairly non-controversial issue.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 2599 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. You're on your way. Congratulations, Representative Falk. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on our agenda, Representative Gunther, another boiler bill, another chance to get visited by Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is another boiler bill, the third one in 3 years, and I hope they last. This is
let's do this, Representative Gunther. Representative Sanders, would you like to move that House File 2855 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Representative Gunther, I thought we'd take care of the technicalities.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is an update for over 100 years of past boiler bills. Most of the laws were written over 100 years ago, and the laws were applicable to the equipment being used during that time. The advancements in technology and constructions have required us to look at how we regulate charter boats and the boiler industry. We are trying to reduce the excessive requirements imposed on boat owners, boiler operators, licensed operators. We have reduced the number of statutes by combining the requirements of several statutes into one grammatical changes were made throughout the statutes to provide updates on current language and to clarify and streamline existing language. Changes were made to update references to the referenced to other standard codes. Major revisions to boiler statutes include the following, and explain that, and I don't think it's going to need a lot of explanation, but to explain that, we have the head of the Boiler Division of the Department of Labor and Industry.
It's another boiler bill and another visit from Mr. Amato. Welcome, sir. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joel Amato, and I'm the Chief Boiler Inspector for the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Like Mr. Gunther, Representative Gunther has said, we've looked at the boiler statutes and we've tried to combine them and take little pieces and make it more streamlined and also reduce excessive requirements on the boiler operators, owners, license holders, and boat owners. And I was going to ask Mr. Gunther about the amendment to this.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we'd like to put in the 2177 amendment, so we'll make the bill the way we want it. And Mr. Amato will explain the amendment.
All right. Representative Sanders, would you like to move the A10-2177 amendment to be before the committee?
So moved, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Mr. Amato, if you could explain the amendment for the committee, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This amendment addresses some of the issues that we missed the first time around. The first one addresses the licenses issued by the department for boat masters in the state. The previous language did not or said that an individual holding a unlimited Coast Guard license did not have to have a Minnesota master's license. We've just clarified that language now to say that any license issued by the United States Coast Guard prevents them from obtaining a Minnesota master's license because they are comparable, and then they would not have to have two licenses. There was another line in the boiler portion of it that required all defects to be corrected in a boiler before the boiler was allowed to operate. Well, that's a little extreme. If you had a scratch in the boiler paint, that would be a defect, and that would not stop the boiler from being operated. So what we did is we placed in the language, if an inspector determines that the boiler pressure vessel is unsafe, then the boiler pressure vessel should not be operated until these unsafe defects have been corrected. Just clarifying that language. Let's see here. We're also requesting that we strike the language of high-capacity boilers and reinsert qualifying boilers. We had attempted to, through working with members of the union, industry, and we've attempted to reduce the inspection requirements on larger boilers. Currently, the only entities that can go to a biennial inspection frequency are boilers in the state that are larger than 200,000 pounds per hour, which just means this is limited to power-producing facilities like Xcel Energy and Northern Minnesota Power, things like that. We wanted to bring that down a little bit because we have other entities that take very good care of their boiler and have very good water treatment programs, and try and allow them to meet these requirements. We've had some opposition to that, and until we resolve these things outside of a legislative committee, we may propose that at a later time. So we're moving back to the original language of qualifying boilers, which are greater than 200,000 pounds per hour at this time. The master's fees amounts, this was a change from another bill that was being proposed, and that is also being reflected here. Also on line 16.19, we are including nitrous oxide gas for vessels that contain nitrous oxide gas that do not require inspection. We listed a number of vessels that we can exempt from inspection due to other requirements, whether it be from Minnesota or Department of Transportation requirements or other inspection requirements, other inspection entities, and then we're just adding nitrous oxide vessels as another vessel that we would not inspect by the department. Line 16.21, we are adding that if these vessels are going to be exempt from the department inspection, that the owner of the vessel must have some sort of planned maintenance program on these vessels to ensure vessel integrity. So in other words, just because we are exempting them from our inspection, we need to have the owner step up to the plate and make sure that they are still inspecting these and making sure that they are still safe in accordance with other requirements. Line 16.24, after heating, we are installing other hot liquid boiler that is vented to atmosphere. These are the boilers that do not create pressure based on the application of heat, and we want to include other hot liquid boilers because now there's many boilers out there used for heating that not only contain water but may contain hot antifreeze or hot oil. And they are heated and circulated through a heating system, but they are unpressurized. So therefore, there is no explosion potential. And the last one, I believe, is 16.24. We're also including small vessels that contain air that are less than, or 1.5 cubic feet or less, or 11.22 gallons in volume, with a maximum allowable working pressure of 600 psi or less. These vessels, we found that because of their construction and because of their size, have very little explosion potential, and we can reduce the inspection requirements by the state.
All right. Representative Gunther, does this amendment get the bill in the form that you wish as the author?
It does, Mr. Chairman.
All right. With that, any discussion to the amendment? Motion, Representative Sanders has made the motion to include the amendment in the bill. All those signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Gunther, Mr. Amato, any other comments to the bill as amended?
No, sir.
Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 2033? Nope, not 2033.
2855.
2855, even better. 2833, you can get in on later. Seeing none, Representative Gunther, any closing comments?
No, I don't. Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to have this bill passed on to Commerce.
All right. With that, Representative Sanders renews his motion that House File 2855, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Excuse me, Commerce and Labor. All those in favor, I get choked up on these boiler bills. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. I got it. Representative Norton, good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. I don't believe you've been here before.
I have never been here.
Treat it's a me pleasure.
Well. Treat me well.
We will do our best, yes.
Okay.
Ms. Faust has asked where the treats are. Aren't you supposed to bring treats the first time you present a bill to a committee? We can hold over the bill until next week.
I think it has
oh,
to be
Oh, not during
stopped,
Lent. Ah, I stand corrected. No treats during Lent.
Oh, all right.
Thank you, Representative
Thank you.
Representative Lilly, would you like to move that House File 3048 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. I understand there is an author's amendment. Is that
there
correct?
There is.
Very good. Is that the A-10-2033 amendment? And this is to put the bill in the order that you prefer?
It is, sir.
Thank you very much. The chair, Representative Lilly, will move the A-10-2033 amendment. Representative Norton, do you wish to explain the amendment?
Certainly I will, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and members, this is simply adding some language. The language it's adding is registered licensed individuals, which were formerly called apprentices. The need for this is that it's a combination of programs, one that used to be through the Department of Health and one that was through the Department of Labor and Industry. They're moving into one section of law, and we need to refer to them under both names at the current time.
All right. Any discussion or questions on the amendment? With that, all those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Norton, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry bill. It has been vetted with the Builders Association of Minnesota, building officials, Minnesota pipe trades, unions. As far as I know, there's no opposition, though it is a bill that has that affects a number of parts of the building code statute. So what I'm going to propose to do, Mr. Chair, unless you feel otherwise, is just walk through about a sentence or two about each of the sections, and then you can either have, if there are questions at the time, we have some department folks here that would answer those, or we can wait till the end and it open up, whatever you prefer.
Why don't you go ahead and walk through the bill, and if there's questions, we can take those after you've completed the walkthrough.
Okay, and I'm going to do this quickly. Please stop me and if you'd like. Section 1 of the bill amends statute to allow persons who wish to receive rulemaking notices electronically to register with the agency. So you can either register with the agency with an electronic address or through paper, pencil, U.S. mail. Sections 2-7 amend Minnesota statute to clarify, for clarity and consistency with changes in the code of federal regulations. So we're changing to comply with federal law. Section 8 deletes some outdated language. Section 9 also deletes language that is being moved and modified slightly into Section 13 below, which I'll explain when I get there. Section 10 amends statute to remove the requirement that one copy of the complete code be filed with the Secretary of State. This filing is no longer useful to the public because the code is available on the department's website. Also, this section replaces the words referred to in with that are incorporated by reference to clarify that all standards which are incorporated into the code by reference will be kept on file at the department. It's not economical to purchase and store every standard that is mentioned in the code. Section 11 amends Minnesota statute to remove the requirement that the commissioner hold all state hearings and make determinations regarding subject matters addressed in the code, including rules proposed by other state agencies. This requirement is no longer necessary because the commissioner is involved in all rulemaking proceedings related to the code, subject matters as required under the APA. The commissioner either is proposing the rules or is represented on the boards that are proposing the rules. Sections 12 and 13 amend statute to remove a requirement to provide certain rulemaking information to the governing bodies in municipalities. It's been the department's experience that the information sent to the governing bodies is not received by the municipality's building department, and the department routinely sends rulemaking notices and code amendment information to every building official who has been designated by the municipality. So it's just an interim step that's being removed. We're going to go directly to the source. Section 12 also adds the word geological in front of the word condition for clarification and consistency. And Section 13, which I referenced early, adds the requirement that an electronic version of the code be made available to municipalities and that the paper copy that was mentioned earlier is available upon request for a fee. So this was the piece that was moved from Section 10. Section 14 amends statute to allow the department to use any tool in Section 326B.082 to enforce the laws and rules in the department's jurisdiction against an individual who has applied for or is holding a building official certificate. This is consistent with other licenses issued by the department. Section 15 clarifies that a person may appeal to the commissioner not only final decisions of any local board, but also appeals, but also final decisions of the State Building Code Appeals Board. So it's clarifying that. Section 16 is outdated language. Sections 17 and 18 are clarifying that municipalities which fail to comply with the existing reporting and remittance requirements are subject to enforcement provisions already in law. Mm-hmm. Section 19 amends statute to remove the requirement that the department submit an annual report on changes to the surcharge. This information is already included in reports submitted by the department, so it's a redundancy. Section 20 corrects any typographical error. Section 21 and 22 clarify that the electrical enforcement orders are now issued by the commissioner and not under the Electrical Act. Section 23 amends statute to allow the department to use any tool to enforce laws and rules within the department's jurisdiction against applicants for or holders of a residential contractor, residential remodeler, or residential roofer licensee or certificate of exemption. This is consistent with other licenses issued by the department. Section 24 adds a definition of owner to statute. Section 25 has three amendments to it. It deletes the phrase, except as otherwise provided in this section, which is unnecessary because this section does not provide for the payment of compensation in excess of the limitations set out in this subdivision. It adds the word per licensee to clarify that an owner who has obtained judgments against more than one licensee might be able to qualify for compensation up to $75,000 in connection with each licensee. And it deletes a sentence, and this sentence was included in the 2007 legislation as part of a transition to the new Contractor Recovery Fund statute. This language is no longer needed because all current licensees have been paid under the Contractor Recovery Fund fee. Section 26 amends statute to correct another typographical error and also adds a new sentence which clarifies that an applicant must include in the application documents evidencing the amount of the applicant's actual and direct out-of-pocket loss. Section 27 clarifies that the applicant must have submitted a complete application before the commissioner is required to act upon it. Section 28 amends statute to make the administrative hearing process more efficient and consistent with another section of law. The amendment requires hearings to be held within 45 days rather than the current 30 days after receipt of a hearing request and allows the party to agree to a longer delay. If the parties agree to the delay, then the new language will avoid the time and expense of a petition to the judge for the continuance. And it also says that a 15-day notice will be given for those hearings if it's held within 45 days. There's the new language in the second paragraph of subdivision 8 would require the applicant to prove the cause of action. If the applicant has obtained a judgment in a situation where the applicant was not required to prove the cause of action in order to obtain a judgment. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I'm getting a frog. Section 29 amends statute to clarify that the owner or leasee must assign to the commissioner all rights in the final judgment before the commissioner pays compensation from the fund. And then Section 30 is an amendment that corrects an inconsistency. The new language allows the owner of a common property and garage for the townhouse or condominium building, as well as owners of townhouses and condominiums, to recover from the fund regardless of the number of units in the building currently. They're only able to recover if the owner has five or more units, and this is broadening that scope. Section 31 to 33 has three new subdivisions. Subdivision 17 makes it a felony to knowingly lie or conceal material information in an application or supporting materials submitted to the commissioner for compensation from the fund. Subdivision 18 is allowing the commissioner to sue an owner or leasee in district court if the commissioner made payments from the fund based on false information. The commissioner could also recover reasonable litigation expenses, including attorney fees. The money recovered would be returned to the fund. And subdivision 19, if anyone makes a false material statement in or admits material information from an application to the fund or other documents that the commissioner requires, then the commissioner could issue an administrative order for violation. Under the proposed language, the penalties recovered as a result of any administrative order would be deposited back in the fund. The bill ends with some repealers. It repeals safety glazing, which is no longer available. And the provisions are addressed in state building code. The second repealer is because we have adopted new energy codes that became effective on June 1st, 2009. So this section of law has expired. The next repealer is because requests for electrical inspection are now available on the department's website, so it's not needed. And the last one has three sections that are repealed because they're obsolete. So, Mr. Chair, that's a very quick down and dirty overview of the various sections of law. The Department of Labor and Industry is here, and I don't profess to be a building code expert. I have read through things, and I have some notes here. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you or the committee has.
I'm betting that you know a lot more about the building code than you did a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. And I'll only become more knowledgeable as this bill moves through the process.
I believe it. Mr. Rakowski, welcome to the committee. Do you have anything to add at this time?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I'm glad to be here. If you have any questions, I might be able to provide some historical context to some of the subdivisions that we put in here and why we put them in here.
All right.
I stand for questions, too.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for the author or the testifier? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 3048? Seeing none. With that, Representative Lilly, if I remember correctly, renews his motion that House File 3048, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. You're on your way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Next up, Representative Mullery. You've been sitting back there so quietly in the dark, Representative Mullery.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just remarking to Mr. Rakowski about how he's such an expert on the building codes and just about anybody in the room is about equal, I think.
The chair would like to move House File 2600 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Mullery. Representative Mullery, if you'd like to introduce the bill, and I know you've got a couple of, there's at least a testifier or two who wish to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. Basically, I first heard of this at NCSL. I'm on their December a year ago, so it'd been 08. And we were told, the members of the financial and commerce section, that we had to enact the SAFE Act, that it was a federal requirement, and you didn't have any choice but to enact the model act that they'd put together. And so I came back and I asked a certain person over in a department about that, and he said he'd take care of it getting done. Well, it didn't happen, and on last roughly August, I got a call from the banking commissioner in Massachusetts, who I've worked with on a lot of foreclosure, and he started off and he says, I know you do things different up there in Minnesota, but are you going to secede from the union or what? We are the only state that did not act and enact the SAFE Act as required by the federal government in its law, and they gave HUD the direction to promulgate the model act that we're supposed to enact. And so HUD promulgated this model act, which this is what we have in front of us. And there is the penalty if we don't enact this is that they come in and set up a licensing system here. And I don't think we really want the federal government coming in and taking over a Minnesota licensing system. And I'm sure that the people that are mortgage brokers here in this state do not want that to happen. So briefly, the Act sets up a definition of loan processors, which is very merely clerical. They can't even offer loan rates or anything like that. They can ask for certain information. That's about it. And then it sets up the loan originators, and it exempts some people, and it does include taking a residential mortgage loan application. Now, the reason I'm bringing that up is that I believe you have somebody from the real estate brokers here, and I'll explain that they are excluded, but there's a possible problem with short sales. I'll explain that later. Independent contractors, though, who are loan processors but not working under directly a licensed mortgage broker, are covered. It goes through a lot of things such as background checks. I want to note that there is something unusual in this and that I haven't seen before, but I'm told, and I've discussed it with Mr. Pender, it does allow the commissioner by rule or order to establish something contrary to our statute if it's required to comply with the nationwide mortgage licensing system and registry. And the reason for that is there is federal preemption in this area and we have to comply. So if the commissioner is directed by HUD, you're going to change this, we have to. And we don't want to have a special session just to do that. Then there's the issuance of the license. There's education, license renewal. There's some enforcement, some civil fines, surety bond required. There's confidentiality issues. And then there's a specific section 16, which is very good about prohibiting certain acts that are considered by the federal government to be misrepresentations and things like that. So, and then each mortgage, each licensed person gets a unique identifier, which is nationwide. So, that if you're doing something fraudulent here and you go someplace else, that record stays with you when you go to someplace else to apply. And do you want to go further in explanation, or do you want just questions? Oh, I forgot to. The one with the realtors, and it just came up 15 minutes before, and I understand their position is that it's difficult on a short sale where the seller doesn't have any money. But this would say that they have to they wouldn't be exempted because the realtor is only exempted if they're not paid by the lender. And there's a reason for that, but a short sale probably from my little knowledge of thinking about this for about 10 minutes. We may want to, in Representative Atkins' committee, if we can find out that we can, we may want to change that on a specific short sale where the seller can't. So they're checking with their national association to see what that is going to be ruled on. But for now, we have to stay with the Model Act.
Okay. Ms. Brown, I respect the fact that you're here, but since we're on the issue of short sales and the nice people from the Realtors Association are looking a little apprehensive, can we bring them up?
Sure.
And deal with this issue at this time?
Come on.
Ms. Berger.
She can just bring over that chair. He just has to slide this one.
We can then return to the broader bill after fully exploring short sales and the SAFE Act.
You don't have to fully explain short sales.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will not do a short sale 101 class right now.
But hopefully you will identify yourself for the tape.
I will, Mr. Chair. My name is Christine Berger, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Thank you for the opportunity. We talked to Representative Mulry this morning. We did have a technical concern with the real estate licensee and brokerage exemption on lines 2.19 to 2.22. And it says basically that real estate licensees are exempt unless they get paid by a lender. And we had one of those aha moments this morning where we went, aha, what if you're paid through a short sale transaction where there's no proceeds from the seller anymore because it's a short sale or it's an REO property and we're paid by a lender. But I was able to reach the National Association of Realtors this morning, and we've been given assurance that we are still, real estate licensees are still protected and exempt from the Act because they're acting in the capacity of real estate activities and not in the capacity of lending activities. We are not taking residential mortgage loans and not offering or negotiating terms of a residential mortgage. And so because we're just acting in a traditional brokerage real estate transaction type of manner, that we still are exempt from having to obtain the additional license.
Okay. So we're good is the short answer on the short sale issue.
Thank you for asking, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, when I spoke to NAR, they recognized that the language was, still not perfect, and so they are going to be doing some clarifying with HUD. They're asking for some more clarification, so I can talk to them about what that clarifying language might be, and maybe we could add something later on if everyone is willing to do such thing.
All right, we're good for today.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
If HUD approves something, I have no problem with going there.
All right.
I just don't want to, since HUD is enforcing, it's kind of like with our Commerce Department, if they put out a form and says you're going to use this and you as a company don't comply, you are kind of looking for problems.
Right. Okay, a practical approach, Representative Mulry. Thank you. Ms. Brown, I appreciate your patience. If you would please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony on House File 2600.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative Dabney and members of the committee. My name is Robin Brown. I work for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I work in the Financial Examinations Division. My responsibilities there are to license mortgage originator companies, check cashing facilities, payday lenders, and money transmitter companies. I'm happy to provide you with some additional information regarding House File 2600. This bill is the Minnesota Secure and Fair Enforcement for Mortgage Licensing Act of 2009 and incorporates some other changes into Chapter 58. It is commonly known among the state regulators, federal regulators, and industry people as the SAFE Act. The SAFE Act is a federal act that was passed in 2008, and it mandates that states participate in this national licensing system for persons who are engaged in residential mortgage loan activities. The nationwide mortgage licensing system was developed by the Conference of State Banking Supervisors and the American Association of Residential Mortgage Regulators, also known as ARMR, if you've heard of that term. And it started out as a voluntary participation by states. However, now that the federal law has been passed, it is now mandatory. As Representative Mulry pointed out, Minnesota is the last state in the country to pass any legislation to comply with this federal SAFE Act. We had generally believed that our laws in Minnesota were pretty strong in consumer to protect consumer protect protect consumers in Minnesota. However, in light of the SAFE Act being passed, we now have to comply with this federal mandate. Minnesota law currently licenses mortgage companies, not the individuals that work for these companies. Chapter 58, the mortgage originator law, requires that companies oversee the activities of their employees. They're required to do background checks on their individual employees, and they're required to make sure that the individuals complete the education that Minnesota law requires. The proposed bill would require the licensing of the individual people. And like the federal SAFE Act law, this law would require that we do fingerprinting, background checks, and licensing of the human beings who are engaged in these mortgage activities. Individuals must register with the National Licensing System. They obtain a unique identifier number. It's the same number that they use for all states that they're doing business in. And they must also complete a national test and a state test. These are all conditions of getting a license, plus annually renewing that license. Licensing of the individuals creates a record in the nationwide system. The nationwide licensing system will license the companies. It's a database for the companies, the branches, and the individuals. The system will hopefully create some uniformity for the individuals who are doing the business in many states. It should reduce some of the regulatory burdens that we certainly have in other states, and hopefully reduce some of the fraud that has been going on in the past. The securities industry has been using a similar system to this NMLS since the early 1980s. For those who will be familiar with the securities laws, the CRD system, or the Central Registration Depository, is what the NMLS system was modeled after. Companies currently licensed in Minnesota under Chapter 58 have to register through the NMLS, and they need to get a unique identifier number, as the individuals do, in order to be able to sell their loans to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That is one of the conditions that the SAFE Act does require. As Representative Mullery said, if states do not adopt some legislation to incorporate the SAFE Act, HUD can, and said that they would come in and create a licensing and registration system. This would probably create an additional regulatory scheme for the people who are already doing business in Minnesota, and probably are not too happy if that would actually happen. House File 2600 would require the department to review applications, screen them, and it does have specifics that where we cannot approve licenses. People who have been convicted of felonies in the past 7 years, we could not issue a license to them. Anyone who's been convicted of a financially related crime could not become licensed in Minnesota. If you've ever had a mortgage originator license revoked, we could not issue a license to an individual. The law also requires that we look at the financial responsibility of an individual. We'll be getting credit reports that are obtained through the National Licensing System, which will allow us to look at whether or not they've got current outstanding judgments, whether or not there's tax liens on the individual, whether or not the person has had any foreclosures in the past 3 years, or whether or not there's any tax liens on the individual. Also looks at the pattern of delinquent accounts, if there are any. And those are all things that we would have to consider before we would issue a license. The law also requires that persons complete 20 hours of education before they get a license, pass the national test and the state test, and then as a condition for annual license renewal, an additional 8 hours of annual continuing ed would be required. There is a bonding requirement in the bill. The company would obtain the bond, and then that would cover the individual loan originators that are employed by that company. The law also requires that companies submit an annual report to the state agencies, giving the activity that has been going on within the company. The bill before you does not contain all of the provisions the department is proposing. After reviewing the proposed bill, we see that there is some fiscal impact on the bill, and the governor's office is currently reviewing the fiscal impact of the fees for the licensure and also the assessment to the industry that Minnesota's fair share of the development costs for the NMLS. Thank you for providing me the opportunity to provide you with the information on this bill, and if you have any questions, I can entertain them.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. I would remind committee members and the audience that the fiscal impact is outside the jurisdiction of this committee. Any questions for the author or the testifier? Seeing none, Representative Mullery, Mr. Bruner has asked to testify from the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, I believe it is. Mr. Bruner, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape. Why don't you go ahead and spell your last name, since you're not a frequent flyer here in the committee, and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Mark Bruner, B-R-U-N-N-E-R, with the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. And our concern with the bill, it isn't really so much with the SAFE Act, as we understand what the SAFE Act requires of each state, is with a simple word change that's in the bill that's different from what's in the federal requirement. And the reason that we have concerns is that the Manufactured Housing Association is our, we have about 400 members. 20 of them are builders of manufactured homes and modular homes. We have 8 plants in the state of Minnesota. Our members also include the sale centers, those locations that would sell manufactured homes or modular homes to consumers. We also have lenders and mortgage companies as members of our association. We represent about 300 manufactured home communities in Minnesota, or the manufactured home parks, and they have about 50,000 home sites combined, and we represent about 85% of those as our members. And what the concern we have with the bill, and I visited with Representative Mullery about that, is on line 215 of the bill, there's a change from what's in the federal requirement of the SAFE Act, which essentially says that if you're a person, in our case a sales center of a manufactured or modular homes, and under the federal act, if you simply take an application for a mortgage from a prospective consumer, and in that sense they fill out this application or two, and you send those applications off to the mortgage company for approval, under the federal act, you're not required to be licensed as a mortgage originator, because it says in the federal act that if you negotiate for a rate or whatever on behalf of the consumer, and you also process that application or do the clerical functions, and the federal act does exempt clerical functions from licensure, you don't need that. However, the what 2600 does is takes language from a model act that was developed, and in that model act, which differs from the federal act, it says or if you take an application. So if you do one or the other under 2600, you need to become licensed in Minnesota, where otherwise, if you're just doing the clerical work and the function and you're not really involved in originating a mortgage, you would not need to be licensed. In my conversation with Representative Mullery, I know you had referred to the, or sort of deferred to the department in terms of where that came from.
Representative Mullery. Mr. Chairman. No, I said that the department was working off of the Model Act, which is, as I explained earlier, promulgated by HUD as what we're supposed to enact. And so it's kind of, if the legislature says we're giving the Commerce Department the right to determine the exact form to do, and they put out a form, I think it would be wise to comply with that until you go and get it changed. And I don't really think that there's anything different from what I think the things that they want to do are much the same as other groups. If you're, I don't know who they are now. It used to be Orrin Thompson and Vernon A. Holmes had all these tract housing, and you went in and somebody would take the same types of things that they take for in the mobile home industry. Those others would be included under this, but they'd want to, the mobile homes want to be excluded, and I don't really understand why we'd make that distinction. But that isn't the major point, unless we're informed that HUD really doesn't mean what they say. I don't want to get into the situation of triggering HUD coming in and taking over our licensing, and I guarantee you most mortgage loan brokers in this state would be very upset if we did something that triggered that.
Representative Simon.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And to whoever wants to answer it, we've been told that Minnesota is the last state to do this. So 49 other states have done it. How have they done it? Has it looked like House File 2600, or has there been some other language?
Who wants us to take that?
Mr.
Representative Mulroy?
Representative Syme, I'm informed that there is one, possibly two states that have made some kind of an exception. We don't know what the exception is or how, if it's couched that some way that exception doesn't work if such and such happens. I don't know exactly how it is.
Mr. Bruner?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Syme. My understanding is that that there are states that have done things differently from the Model Act, but not necessarily out of compliance with what's required in the federal legislation. I know some states have actually put a separate exclusion in for those who engage in sort of the clerical functions when they're selling manufactured homes. And so, you know, Representative Mulroy is correct. There have been some different approaches. And really all we're doing is just asking that Minnesota follow the federal requirement versus the model. The Model Act came from the Association of Bank Supervisors as their proposed language, which does exceed what HUD requires in terms of its minimum or what congressional intent was. Thank you.
All right. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After listening to Mr. Bruner's testimony, and then actually just even a few minutes ago, Representative Mulroy, you stated that you were fine with HUD's stance in regards to realtors, and that they were not going to regulate them, nor were they going to require licensure for administrative tasks. I think that the manufactured home sales folks are asking for the exact same thing for the exact same reasons. And to me, this goes beyond just manufactured home sales. I mean, we could be looking at clerical workers that are making copies, passing the application from one spot to another, residential contractors who build a model home and have the ability to sell that home. So I do see it as a very important distinction. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an oral amendment.
Representative Sanders.
To that, thank you, Mr. Chair, on line 2.15, strike or and add the word and.
All right. The motion before us then, again, on 2.15, strike the word or at the end of that sentence. Pardon? And insert, thank you, insert the word and. Representative Mulroy, to the amendment.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Sanders, there's no comparison. You said you didn't see any difference between the realtor's issue and this. There's absolutely no comparison. They're totally not connected in any way. So that doesn't make it, that argument just doesn't make any sense. But as I said before, the act is promulgated by HUD, and if you comply with it, they have said you're in compliance. It's my understanding from Ms. Brown that there's one state, Iowa, that has changed it for mobile homes and possibly one other one. But we don't know what they've done on it. We don't know whether HUD has approved it or not. So I'm very opposed to changing a model act that was promoted and says if you do this, you're in compliance. We're already kind of tweaking their nose quite a bit by having said basically we weren't going to do it until they started raising the hammer on us and saying, do you get it? Mm-hmm. So I don't think we should be changing what they're promulgating. If we learn in the future, then I think that's an issue to come back to sometime.
All right. Mr. Bruner, what sort of licensure does a salesperson in a manufactured home situation have?
The manufactured home, the sales center, or the retailer is licensed. I had a handout that perhaps it made it around, but I did a brief description of a manufactured home retailer. They are required to be licensed. They have a to get a license, the sales center, the owner, applicant undergoes a criminal background check. They're required to have a $20,000 bond for each location they might have, and they're also required to carry a $1 million in general liability insurance. All of these policies are directed towards consumer protection. The people who work at the sales center are required to be listed by the license holder with the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, and they also do provide some personal information about how to reach these people beyond the sales center. They're not beyond that required to hold a license. If the sales center is engaged in any type of mortgage activity, they are required to hold a mortgage originator's license, or they may hold a license under Chapter 53C for installment sales contracts. The change that we're talking about, Representative Sanders' amendment, would not change any of that. We're not suggesting that anybody who is currently required to be licensed as a mortgage originator, as a business, or to hold an installment sales license would in any way become exempt. What it would say is that these salespeople who are currently just performing clerical functions, if you will, in taking an application, sending it on to a lender, and the lender then gets back to the potential home buyer that they've been approved or disapproved, is what the change to and would do. And even beyond the salespeople, we're also talking about clerical people in the office. It may not be the salesperson who actually takes the application. It may be the someone else in the office who does that processing. They too would then be required to hold a license if we leave the or in 2600 versus change it to and. So it actually goes even beyond just a salesperson. It would cover anybody at the sales center that, you know, touches the application or essentially answers a question of the home buyer. And we just, you know, we think that does go beyond congressional intent of what's currently in the law.
Ms. Brown, does the department concur that the clerical person behind the scenes who puts the application in the envelope and puts the stamp on would be required to register with the department as a loan originator, as Mr. Bruner has indicated?
It's my understanding that those performing clerical and administrative functions are not required to be licensed.
Right. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe that's the exact reason why we need this oral amendment to clarify that. And again, one of the reasons why Congress exempted the realtors was because they understood the large administrative role that realtors play in the mortgage process, which is very similar to the role that a manufactured home salesperson plays in the mortgage or the loan process. It is very administrative in type. So I do see that there is a strong correlation in that argument. But again, I think that this does extend, as Mr. Bruner said, beyond just manufactured home salespeople, but into clerical workers, residential contractors, and if you get extreme, you know, does the person at Kinko's, if you fax the application, they're involved in the process. So I do think that in order to clarify what the department said and again what they're doing with realtors, that this amendment does make sense, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Although, Representative Sanders, the department has been clear that clerical people are exempt. Right. Representative Simon.
Well, thank you. That's a nice segue, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question to probably to the department and to Representative Mullery is this. So what we're being told is that the Federal SAFE Act has the and language in. This Model Act has the or language in. I'm wondering, apart from just wanting to be consistent with the Model Act, could you just educate us, why do you think it's important to keep or in there? What would be the harm of putting and in there? Other than, I know we want to keep consistent, but just taken by itself, is there a policy reason why you believe that we should have the or in there instead of the and?
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I think that there is reasons for that, and I, it, what Representative Sanders said just is not the case. You know, things like duplicating, it's got nothing to do with that. As Ms. Brown said, if it's purely clerical, they're not covered. And as I said, there's this is promulgated. It's not a model act put out by NCSL or something like this. It's promulgated by the people who have said, if you comply, we're not going to come in and regulate you, which is a totally different story from what most of our model acts are. They're put together by Uniform Laws Commission or state NCOIL or NCSL or whatever. There's a number of things that I happen to not perfectly agree with in this act. I think that I would like to exclude such as Habitat for Humanity counselors on foreclosures, but we can't. They came in and asked me, and I said, yeah, it sounds like a good idea. We looked into it. We can't. They are going to go to Congress, which is that, and I there's a number of things that, but I think that in this case it actually makes sense, because they are in essence getting the information from the people, and it's not merely clerical, or else they're not covered.
Representative Simon.
Well, just to follow up on that, because I think Representative Sanders makes a good point. We don't want this to go to the extreme. You know, we don't want people who are involved in faxing and copying and all that. I don't think anyone wants that. And we're hearing from the department that that would be exempt. Is there a rule, or is there something in statute that maybe you or someone else could get to us to give us some comfort? Because I think Representative Sanders brings up a very good point. But if we can be assured, well, I'll speak for myself, if I can be assured that the clerical stuff would be outside of this, and if there's some language in there, in rule or in statute, that would give me a lot more comfort. But and if not now, then after the hearing, it seems to make common sense that we don't want to start regulating people whose only role is pretty much clerical or facilitating information.
Mr. Pender, you have some insight to guide us, please.
Mr. Chair, there is language in this bill, and it matches what's in the federal act. It shows up in our bill at the top of page 2. There's a definition there of loan processor or underwriter, and I'll just summarize it here, but it's a person who performs clerical or support duties as an employee at the direction of or supervision of a person who's licensed under this act. And then it goes on further to say it may include, after the receipt of an application, receiving, collecting information, distributing it, communicating with a consumer to obtain the information necessary to process the loan, to the extent that it doesn't involve actually offering or negotiating loan rates or counseling consumers. And then down below, just below that in the definition of mortgage loan originator, at lines 2.17 to 2.18, it says that the mortgage loan originator doesn't include a person who's engaged solely as a loan processor or underwriter, except, and then there's an exception there, which references something else in the act that refers to people who are acting as independent contractors, in other words, who aren't employees of a licensed person, but are just kind of doing it on their own. So they would not be eligible for this exemption from the definition of mortgage loan originator, but ordinary people that are just doing processing of handling paper, copying things and so on, and aren't directly interacting with the customer and, you know, advising them on what kind of loan to get and so on, those kind of people that are just doing the support functions would not be included in this definition of mortgage loan originator.
So, Mr. Pender, to spin a scenario here, if I'm working the front end of a manufactured home sales situation, and you come in and purchase a home and then say, okay, I've got to finance it, and I say, well, here's a standard application and a list of a couple of places that offer loans for manufactured homes, I, provided that I'm an employee and not an independent contractor, I would be covered under the loan processor or underwriter language at the top of page 2 and therefore exempted from the mortgage loan originator and licensing language in the middle of page 2. Am I correct?
I guess I'd say so, Mr. Chair. I think as long as it was made clear that this is just a, that this application you're giving them is just a, you know, one type of loan application from one source and not giving them advice or anything like that. I think one of the ambiguities here in this definition of mortgage loan originator in general is, and I mean the discussion here has been correct that I have the federal law in front of me, and the federal law says and not or on line 2.15. But I, at least to me, part of the ambiguity is here is that term in line 2.15 takes, and does that mean simply being in the office and passively accepting a loan application that's been, you know, that's been filled out where you're just having a clerical function, or is it something more, you know, does it mean something more than that? And that term takes is not defined in here.
All right. But it Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, well, as usual, thank you, Mr. Pender, for explaining that. That's helpful as always. What I'm wondering, since I'm anything from an expert in this area, if someone could testify to why, do we know why there's the exception from the exemption for independent contractors? In other words, Mr. Chair, you just described a situation. Mm-hmm. If someone just literally takes the residential mortgage loan application, then they would be exempted from this if they work for a company that does this kind of thing. But if they're an independent contractor, for some reason, they wouldn't be, the exemption wouldn't apply to them, so they are then regulated. I'm just wondering why we do that. I mean, is there some reason that someone knows, either at the congressional level or here, why that would be the case?
Mr. Pender, can you explain Congress to us, please?
not even close. maybe Representative Mullery could, but I'll just say, I as I understand the reason, it's because if you're working as an employee of someone, you're of a licensed person, a person who's licensed here, you're being supervised by that mm-hmm. person, and you're performing clerical functions under supervision of a licensed person. Whereas, as if you're an independent contractor, you're contracting with someone to do this work, and you're not. I mean, the definition of an independent contractor is that you're not closely supervised. You're being paid for your output. And the person contracting with you, at least theoretically, has no ability to control how you do the work. It's just whether you do the work. So I think that's the reason for that difference.
Well, Representative Mullery, then Representative Murdoch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Simon. Exactly, the department says if you're working under someone, you're working under a licensed person. They can take action against them, the bond, the company, all kinds of things. If you're an independent contractor, nothing. There's no protections whatsoever.
You know, our constituents sometimes wonder what we do all day, and I'll explain 20 minutes on or versus and see how that goes. Representative Murdoch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anybody can respond to this question, I guess. We have a whole bunch of residential, you know, builders out here, and they're not required to have a real estate license to sell their spec homes. So are they going to be exempted from this?
Ms. Brown, I'll throw that to the department.
I don't know the answer to that question. You said the building contractors that are out there?
Like a residential builder.
Mr. Murdoch.
We have, thank you, sorry, Mr. Chair, and or, but anyway. You know, anybody that has a construction business, and we have quite a few in Burham up north, and, you know, would they have to be licensed under this if they have loan information, you know, at their spec home?
Ms. Brown.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. If they are taking an application, if they're negotiating terms and conditions for a residential mortgage loan, yes, they would fall under this. They would be required to be licensed.
Representative Murdoch.
If they're negotiating, but if they just hand out an application, you know, in their spec home to a prospective buyer, they wouldn't be?
Excuse me, thank you. Again, the question is whether or not they're taking an application. Is that a clerical or ministerial function? That is one of the questions. Actually, there are some rules that have been that are proposed by HUD that are under comment right now. I think the comment period that expires in the next week to 10 days, something like that. These very issues have been will be addressed by HUD. They're accepting comment on the manufactured housing issue, what is taking an application, those types of things. We may get further guidance from HUD on these very issues.
Okay, thank you.
With that, Representative Sanders renews his motion that on line 2.15, we strike at the end of that line the word or and insert the word and. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chairman, division?
Division has been called. All those in favor indicate your support by raising your hand. All right. All those opposed? Tie does not go to the runner, unfortunately, Representative Sanders. All right. Any further testimony on House File 2600 as not amended? With that, did I do this?
You did.
I did. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 2600 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mullery, for the insightful conversation. Thank you, Representative Lilly.
Chair Daphne, would you like to move your bill, sir?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3127 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Do we have any amendments, sir? I'm sorry, I didn't. No amendments?
There should be an amendment in the packets, am I correct? Or did we delay that to the next committee? We will be dealing with that in the next committee. My apologies. That's Mr. Chair and members.
Daphne, we have your bill before us. Go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, sir. This bill is the product of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which is a large and unwieldy group of including members of business and labor, nonprofit organizations, the staffing industry, as well as representatives from the department, administrative law judges who oversee this area of law and others. There's a number of smaller provisions. I'll focus instead, because of the time, on the major provisions. Currently, the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund is in deficit and is projected to be in deficit for a number of years. The current statute would, through an anomaly in the language, provide for an automatic decrease in employer tax rates, which would have the effect of increasing the deficit in the fund. The proposal before you would modify the current statute to provide the tax rates will not decrease so long as the trust fund is in deficit. It provides an incentive for employers to prepay unemployment insurance taxes early by providing a discount. Thus strengthening the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. That's an advantage potentially for the employer as well as for the fund. It provides the new employers in the construction industry receive an average tax rate for construction industry employers rather than the current fixed rate. And the current state extension on unemployment insurance, which is a backfill for those applicants who do not qualify for a federal extension, is currently set to expire on June 30th of this year. The proposal will extend the date until June 30th of 2011 and would modify the amount of the benefits. With me today is Mr. Nelson from the department, and he knows all.
Thank you, Chairman Daphne. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm legal counsel to the DEED, the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Representative Dabney did an excellent job. He is on our advisory council, an excellent job of describing the bill. I can answer any technical questions regarding this bill. this bill does have broad-based support of both business and labor groups and nonprofit groups, many of whom are in the audience, and we believe it will strengthen the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to point out that Representative Murdoch also serves on the Unemployment Insurance Council and makes the long schlep down a number of times to participate.
Thank you, Chair Daphne. And Mr. Nelson, I noticed that you had some co-authors on the bill, and so not only does he serve, he even signed on to your bill.
Yes.
So that's good. Any questions for the author? Representative Loon, I'm sorry. Good morning.
Okay. I'm hiding back over here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for the author. You mentioned that one of the changes was to move in the construction industry from a fixed rate to an average rate. Could you just explain for those of us who are coming to this fresh what result that will have? I assume that has something to do with kind of the seasonal nature of construction and impact on the fund, but
I'll, if I may, Mr. Chair, toss that to Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Loon, well, currently it's a fixed rate. If an employer is a new business, this only applies to new businesses in the construction industry if they operate. It's a statutory fixed rate. Actually, the business community a number of years ago when we put this in place actually asked for a floating rate. And so we're now, with our new computer systems, able to handle that. And what it says is we take all the employers in the construction industry and average out what the rate would be, and that's what a new business would be assigned. They don't get an advantage. They don't get a disadvantage. But if the average rate throughout the construction industry drops, then the new employer rate will drop. If the average goes up, then their rate goes up. They don't get an advantage, but they don't get a disadvantage. And currently, with a fixed rate, they can get an advantage, or they could get a disadvantage, depending upon how the construction is, how the construction industry is doing as far as their unemployment rates go. So this gives them the pure average, which is what all other employers provide. So we consider construction separate from all other employers, and all other employers currently get the average for all other employers. So this makes the construction industry the same as for all other employers.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Representative Loon, any?
No, thank you.
Chair Daphne, are you aware of anyone else that would like to be heard?
No one has contacted my office, and some folks are smirking in the audience, so I think we're okay.
With that, Chair Daphne renews his motion that House File 3127 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee of Commerce and Labor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? You're on your way, sir.
Thank you. Oh, we could do the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Chair Daphne moves the minutes for the February 19th meeting. Any question? Any discussion? Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
The minutes have been adopted. Chair Daphne, any final parting words for our next meeting? Or
see you all next week.
Okay. With that, we're adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.